Today, we are exploring how to build a modern slash scaled SDR team with Colin Stewart, the CEO of Predictable Revenue. Here's what Colin has done. He bootstrapped Predictable Revenue to millions in revenue. He expanded the revenue team to 11 members, grew three companies from zero to 1 million as only sales hire. Welcome to the SDR Game, the podcast designed to boost your sales career and help you build more pipeline. In this episode, we'll discuss the differences between a delegated SDR model and a scale model, how to develop a scale model from the ground up, and the essential tools and infrastructure required. Let's get started. Colin, thank you for being on the show.
Thanks for having me on. I follow you on LinkedIn. It's fun to be on the other side of the podcast. I'm in Riverside all the time, and I recorded a couple episodes already today. It's nice being the one who's not asking the questions. Asking questions is hard work, so thanks for all that you do.
Of course, and now you are on the other side of Riverside.
Yes.
And funny, I forgot to share that with you actually, because the way I started my career in sales was through the book of Predictable Revenue. I read the book and I started to implement Predictable Revenue at my first marketing role. Actually, I was in marketing, and that's how I started in sales.
Dirty. Me too.
Yep. Nice.
Yeah.
Today, we're here to talk about what you're currently doing at Predictable Revenue, because when we are preparing the episode, you are talking about the way you are building a scale model. First thing, I think how we could start is, can you explain the difference between the normal SDR model versus the scaled SDR model?
I'm going to offer a description, and it's by no means saying that one way is better than the other. So I just want to say that without malice or intent or anything. But it's sort of like the difference between Tony Stark and Iron Man. Tony Stark is a regular human walking around, but he can't bench press nearly as much as Iron Man. He's in great shape, but also Iron Man can't operate without power. If Tony Stark needs to go sewing, you're definitely not putting on the Iron Man suit. If he needs to go punching through walls, the Iron Man suit works great. And so the way we see the world is there are different styles of sales development. And what we have developed is a very specific style akin to putting on the Iron Man suit. The reason we've done it is not because it is the absolute greatest sales development methodology or tactics or whatever. It's not because there aren't one set of tactics that are right for everyone that you could take, okay, here's the silver bullets that you got from Colin, go and implement them yourself. Those don't exist. They're not real. 10 years ago, they were real. Send a whole bunch of fucking emails and you're fine. You know, maybe make some calls, maybe personalize some shit, but like that's what worked so well 10 years ago that it was irresponsible to spend any time calling because email works so well. That environment is gone and it's changed. And what we've put together is basically what helps us kind of serve a couple of purposes. It helps us put a really good product, deliver a really good service for our customers that gives us the highest chance of booking meetings, like a good amount of meetings as quickly as we possibly can for the widest range of customers. And so it is not the best. It's the best for us. It's the best for our customers. It's the best for people that are trying to figure out if outbound is going to be a thing. It gives you a couple of different ways of testing things. I just want to make sure I'm not coming across as like, everybody should do this. And I do think a lot of companies could benefit from stealing this model, and I'm going to share it a little bit later, but I just wanted to call it out that like, there's a time and a place for this model. There's a time and a place for taking the Iron Man suit off and sewing. There's a time and a place for any other styles.
I would say negative feedback I have about sales podcast generally, it's, oh, someone say, give a tip and everyone say, oh yeah, but it doesn't apply to everyone. And because everyone thinks, oh yeah, it works for you, but it's not going to work for me. So I think it's a good comment because yes, it works for you. But today we're going to talk about why is it working for you and to dig into that. And maybe yes, not going to work for everyone. So.
Totally. I strongly agree. I think a lot of the things that you see on the internet, I think the most important piece to look at when you're trying to interpret, hey, will this advice work for me, is what is the source? In the early days, like it was Zenefits. When did Zenefits scale? They were like all crazy in 2014, something along those lines. If you went and asked anybody who worked at Zenefits, email was the only thing that you should do. They were sending millions of emails, all from Parker Conrad's, in Parker Conrad's name, off of their parent domain, and it was all like Parker Conrad. They must have had 100 emails that all said Parker Conrad. And like, if you talk to anybody, be like, oh, this is the only way. If you interviewed everybody from Zenefits, and I've talked to a few people, and they weren't all like this, and so I'm just using them as an example, but the people that run it were really, really smart. Somebody would say, hey, this is what worked really well for us. And you could just go and send 2 million emails in your CEO's name. And you know what? While yes, you can, you're not going to get the same benefits that Zenefits did, because your brand is different. Your market opportunity is different. Your CEO has a different reputation. There are so many variables to factor in. What I will share is like, this is what's worked for us. Try it. If it doesn't work, that's okay.
Yeah, but I'm sure they're going to get some nuggets, some tips that they can still leverage for them. So, but yeah, and if you go back to what you are talking about, sending a lot of emails, yeah, because before it was working really well nights with spam filters and a lot of, you can still send more emails, but it's not this, but maybe not the same way.
It's possible. It doesn't mean you should.
Exactly. So let's go back on, you said that's working for you. I'm curious to understand what's the benefit of using it for you, because you said that's improving the service for your customers, but also you are talking about outbound specifically and the way it's working for you. So what's the benefit for you to use this model?
The first up, especially we're recording this in May 2024, people are, I'd say the market for a $15,000 a month SDR, outsourced SDR solution has shrunk. There are still companies out there that have really, really large deals, but 3 years ago, 4 years ago, everybody cared about growth at all costs. And so pricing on outbound services, like we were charging like $8,000 in SDR, dedicated SDR, no big deal. Like never got any pushback. The last couple of years, we start to see a little bit more pushback. Everybody went from growth at all costs to profitable growth. And with that was pressure to get the price down. But with an outsourced model, you can push the price down, and there are competitors that will guarantee you 20 meetings a month and charge you $2,000. And just like I'll tell any customer who comes to me and says, oh, they'll charge us this, can you lower your price? I'm like, no, because it's not possible to do sales development well for less than what we charge. And so we hold very firm on discounting. And like, because I don't want to compromise the quality. And so for us, the decisions we made were to get our cost where we could be, to balance a reasonable cost and a reasonable level of effectiveness. And what I wanted to do is maximize, I wanted to get the cost as low as I possibly could while still maintaining a strong chance of hitting like an 80% chance of getting a customer to 2 meetings a week within 4 months. And so that's the line that we're trying to walk. Those are the metrics that we're trying to optimize for. Do we get every customer there? Fuck no. It's a hard business. And if you're listening, you're like, oh, should I start an outsourcing business? No, don't do it. It's a terrible business. Only idiots start outbound shops. I will stand by that. I'll print it on a t-shirt. I'll tattoo it across my forehead because I'm the idiot that started an outbound shop. I started it because I loved it and I didn't know anything else. And that's a different story. But the decision we made was our customers wanted the most profitable, best chance at being profitable on the engagement, which means we want to optimize for the probability that we get to 2 meetings a week, 8 meetings a month, roughly. Now, give or take, don't take this as like everybody that we work with gets there, because if you're going to enterprise or if you don't have a strong product market fit, there's all these variables. So caveat. But good customer, good product market fit, good engagement, 2 meetings a week, done. We wanted to optimize 80% chance of getting there within 4 months, because we know our customers care about profitability. And so we generally get like 4 to 6 months of leeway. It used to be like 8 to 12 months, you know, and you get like little signals along the way. That's compressed. And during the pandemic, it was 2 months. Everybody's like, oh, you got to show me a closed deal in 2 months. And I'm like, this is not going to happen. I can lie to you and tell you that it's going to happen, but it's not going to happen. And so I've been on sales calls. I'm like, hey, do you want me to lie to you and tell you, or do you want me to be honest? I've had some people say, just lie to me, put it in the proposal. Like, all right, man, that's fine. You took whatever pill that was in the matrix where you get to live the nice life in the stakes. So we optimize for speed to that 2 meetings a week, because we were trying to optimize for profitability within the first like 4 to 6 months. Again, it's hard to get there because I'm speaking to, I don't know who your audience is, but I'm assuming it's more than you. If you and I were having a conversation about your services, I could be much more confident. But even still, I would still probably caveat.
I remember when we were preparing the episode, you were talking also about the de-risking the role, because yes, it's for profitability also, but how do you de-risk the Monarch here?
So that's kind of the how we optimized for clients. And then when I think about the benefits and kind of de-risking it for us internally, you think about the life of an SDR as a hard life. If you think about a life of an SDR at an agency like ours, it's even harder because you're kind of playing client roulette. If you're a dedicated SDR and you're working for one of these shops, the next client that comes in and you're available might be Uber, but it might be the 19th clone of Uber in 2024. And like one of those is going to get a 33% meeting booking rate. The other one is going to get 33 replies lifetime if you're lucky. So, you know, one of the things that we wanted to, I'll be honest, we didn't actually plan for this. We tried out the model with a couple SDRs, and what we heard is feedback from them, which I didn't think we were going to hear, was they really liked it because it reduced the likelihood of them ending up on a crappy client. Or a client that's hard to book meetings, or a client where they don't love the product, or a client where the value prop just doesn't resonate. And so it made it easier for us to run this because we could have fewer higher paid SDRs. They had an easier time because they didn't, there's no way you're going to get, it's less likely that you're going to get stuck with one really crappy client. It also made it easier for us as a business because if I got an SDR, he's like, hey, I'm doing well on this one. I'm not doing well on this one. It makes it, it shows you that one, this SDR can produce. So it's not likely that it's the SDR. It could be the SDR that match with the client, the match with the industry. It makes it easier to swap SDRs with a client. You don't have to go and hire or keep a backlog or a bench. And in order to do those things, they're very costly. So you're either making $0 for the first 4 months, or you've got to have a kind of a bit of a flexible model, especially if you want to pay your people well. And so it made it better for our SDRs. It gives them more exposure to more clients. It made it less likely they get stuck on a crappy client or a client that they don't resonate with. It made it easier for us to kind of swap in new SDRs. And SDRs are basically sharing two clients. I think I skipped that part. Now, the trick is when we went from full-time dedicated to fractional, like we did, well, split, I don't know, whatever you want to call it, we call it fractional. Our clients' expectations didn't change. Price went down, obviously, but the expectations of like, okay, we still need to hit two meetings a week didn't change. And that's the magic and kind of the scaled model that we're going to talk about today. They were probably, I mean, aside from the labor side of things, and there was a lot of organization and kind of structural process change that we had to make in order to make this work. There's kind of two or three big pieces. I think the first big piece was Clay. We use this tool to basically sort for two things. We use it to sort our accounts. So we use Apollo. We pull in a big dumb list from Apollo. And I don't mean anything bad about Apollo, but you don't have to put as much thought into it when you build an account qualification model in Clay. And so that's what I mean by dumb list. So you build out the kind of like your standard criteria, you download it from Apollo, you fire it into our Clay model. And the Clay model is something we'll build on behalf of a customer where it says, hey, these are the four or five variables that make a client more or less likely to be ready to buy right now, or more likely to be open and interested in a conversation. And I don't want to go on my like, I don't like intent data, but this is about as close as you can get to kind of manufacturing your own intent. We'll call them signals. It's not really intent data, but it's just signals that you can use to prioritize the accounts. It's not necessarily like call these ones, don't call these ones. It's call these ones first because they could be more likely. And so that's the first step is using Clay, sorting the accounts, sorting the contacts, and then enriching them with mobile data. ZoomInfo does a pretty good job at mobile. Apollo does a pretty good job. Having a main data source with Clay on top, just make sure that you're getting as high a percentage of mobile data, direct phone numbers as possible.
I love that the way you start talking about this, because you are talking about intent. For me, I think it's the most important in terms of prioritization, because at some companies that I used to work for, a lot of reps were contacting accounts that we shouldn't spend time on. And here, that's something you can do because you can do that at scale. It's not like just someone who is doing it manually, because with Clay, I think it's making it so much easier now because Clay can gather some information from the website, the tech, a lot of things that before you couldn't do with the other tools. You could have like a scoring model, but it was based on the data that this tool was using. So we were using like a tool from Oracle. I don't remember the tool actually, but this tool was giving us a score, but they were not verifying the information. Well, you didn't know what was the source of the information. So sometimes it was great info, but sometimes it was not. So but you can do a lot of things with it. So
Clay is an amazing tool and I absolutely love it. It takes a little bit to get to this level. So don't jump into Clay and your first thing, try and build an account qualification model. Start small, follow their tutorials, jump into their Slack groups. They're super helpful, or pay somebody handsome for their advice on how to do it.
That's another quick solution.
Yeah.
If tomorrow you are building a team from scratch, let's say you stop working at Predictable Revenue and tomorrow you start like, we don't care if it's an agency or if you are starting an SDR team from scratch, but let's say you want to use this model again, what do you do first?
I don't know. I think honestly, going back 12 years, I would do things differently. But if I was starting over again, I don't think I would step into a role where I'm running an SDR team, because candidly, I've been doing this for 12 years and then I was a salesperson, sales leader for 10 years before that. I just don't enjoy the day-to-day tactical of like writing cold calling, writing sequences, this and that. I've been doing it long enough. And I'm like, you know what? It's not something I would start over tomorrow. But I think what you're asking is like, what is the, you know, if somebody is starting fresh, where would I start?
The way I'm thinking about it, the way you've been doing it, that's something I know we can build in-house. So it's not like because you have an agency, you need that. But I think in-house, we can still run the same operation, because the way I'm thinking about more and more the SDR model is we need, the AI is here, the AI player, whatever we have today, it's here to help us be more efficient. And today, maybe with the tools we can have, and if the quota for a rep is 16 meetings, for example, in-house, with tools, what's the potential, for example, of the productivity of the team without adding more headcounts? Because now it's, can we do the same thing with 4 reps versus 8 reps? Because, you know, the headcount scaling the team is, in terms of training and enablement, it's really a lot of effort. So, but can we do the same with tools and produce the same results with 4 reps instead of 8, for example?
I'm being a bad podcast guest and dodging your questions. I'm not trying to be difficult. I just wanted to add some caveats there. To get to your very good question that I've been dodging, what would I do if I was starting fresh? The caveats here are like, it depends on the size of the market and the size of the sale. And so let's say a mid-range B2B sale, like say kind of 50K and a fairly large market. If it's 100K and smaller market, I'm going personalized pretty much everything. I would almost think about doing it manually, like no automation whatsoever. And the secret reason why is like when you send an email through a tool like Apollo or SmartLead or I can't remember the other ones, but Google knows, Microsoft knows. When you send it from a mail merge and a Google Sheet, Google knows. And it gives, a mail merge has a significantly better email deliverability rate than Apollo or SmartLead or any of those tools, because it's coming from internal Google and they know, and there are different rate limits and there are different mechanisms to allow the emails in and out. And the same is like, if you send it personally through like manually through your Gmail, there are different, there's much different guidelines. And so you can go really quickly. You can get really good deliverability doing it manually. And so on the scale of like, if I'm selling $1 million deals, I'm probably doing everything, sending everything in Gmail. There's no automation whatsoever. I'm doing all the calls from my mobile phone with my phone number attached. I'm doing all the prospecting from my LinkedIn. I probably have something that's helping me organize my prospects. I'm a janky spreadsheet kind of guy. Like if I'm only working, you know, 10 companies and 100 prospects, I probably don't need much of a CRM. If it was just me, I'd probably do it manually. And I'm sure there are tools out there that people are going, oh, well, you could use X or Y. It's like, yeah, but there's complexity and there's cost. And so that's if it was like $1 million deals. If it was sort of back to these like 50K deals, what would I do? I would probably do something like the scaled model that we have. And I would see what works in my target audience, because the channels, the big channels you want to pay attention to are obviously LinkedIn, cold calling and email, I'll put. And there's different ways of doing them. If you're listening, you're like, hey, what are some things that I could try? I'll give you a counterexample of what we're doing versus what everybody else is doing. What everybody else is doing right now is the triple touch and the this and the that. Because the theory is, if you send somebody a phone call, if you call somebody, you leave them a voicemail, you send them an email and you hit them up on social, all within blah, 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 it's going to increase your response rates. Because Sales Loft said it was true because they did some studies, and Outreach said it was true because they got some software to sell you. And I don't think anybody's lying or being misleading, but what we've tested and what we've seen is when you don't try and do the traditional multi-touch, when you do two campaigns side by side, one cold call, one cold email, and it could be mass scaled cold email, it could be personally written cold email, it could be somewhere in between. You could have AI intent signals, you could have blah, 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 blah. But when we ran OmniTouch, where you've got a kind of clunky triple touch workflow versus two independently running campaigns, the SDR output, just as like a human output, is 30% higher.
Okay.
So that was kind of unlock number one for us, was we realized that by using this really clunky workflow in Apollo Outreach, we were using Outreach first, then we moved to Apollo, and we had this like triple touch, this and that, we noticed that our SDRs are really getting bogged down in the tool. You're like, okay. Because I would sit and just watch them. You're like, hey, screen share, let me see you do this.
Interesting. I have a question about this before we talk about that. So yeah, because of triple touch, I've read about it and read it. I don't just remember the book where I read it. But so if you have two sequences, do you have like your SDR, do they call the same day, or do you have like the day one?
What worked for us was giving the SDRs a little bit more freedom. And so they've got a cold email campaign that supports them. And we vary that based on the type of market they're going in, size of market, scope. So is it like personalized? Is it automated? Is it blah, 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 blah. But that generally is going to sit, unless we're doing fully personalized, that's generally going to sit and run in the background. And they'll do their Apollo triggers off of that. So somebody, you know, opens a bunch of times, they'll call and yada, yada, yada. And then on the other side, we take the same list and we have enrich it with as many mobiles as we can. And we fire it up into Aurum and we say, hit your call quota every day, you know, and it's, you know, X calls every day. And you can do X calls in Aurum, you can do, you know, 20 in Apollo, and you can do 100 here, or you can do 150 here, or, you know, on average, I think peak is probably, with Aurum, you can dial a whole bunch of lines. You can do 5 lines at a time. I don't think it's a good idea to do that many lines at a time. Our SDRs are doing maximum 2, maybe 3 lines at a time if we're going a really wide scaled approach.
Why 2 or 3 versus 5, for example?
So there's two things. In what we've experienced with a lot of these parallelized dialers is the more lines you were dialing, the longer the gap is between when a prospect answers the phone and you get connected. And in some of them, like we used one other dialer, I won't say the name, but the gap was like 5, 6, 7 seconds. There was I listened to an 11-second gap once. Wow. And I was like, I cannot believe the prospect hung on and listened and waited for 11 seconds. They did. The SDR booked a meeting. Like, how? There's no way. I hear like that little click a second later and somebody calls me and I hang up. I also understand I'm not the average person that gets cold called. So yeah. So the first reason is when you dial more lines at a time, the gap is longer.
Okay.
But second, mathematically, when you're dialing 5 lines at a time and somebody answers, you get connected, you also hang up on 4 other lines. So every time you get a connect, you're hanging up on 4 people, which, you know, somebody has seen it and was trying to pick up, and then this other person just answered first. So you're moving through that list a little bit quicker. And the chances of a feel bad with a prospect are higher. And so even though we do have Aurum, we'll dial, I think, 2 or 3 lines at a time.
You run your numbers quicker also.
The nice thing about a tool like Aurum or parallel dialer, power dialer, is it gives the SDRs freedom to call who they want when they want. You can work, you know, you can grab this part of the list, you can tag it, you can sort it, you can kind of do, you could start from wherever, as opposed to when you're locked into a sequence, it's like, okay, this step, that step, call here, email here, this here. And you can kind of sort and filter things in different tasks, in different tools. But if you kind of let the system kind of push and pull you around, you're context switching between calling and then emailing and then LinkedIning and then, oh, I'm on LinkedIn and I'm, oh, a sales humor and then, oh, a prospect and then this and that. And suddenly I've lost 45 minutes. Whereas this allows them to do a call block of, okay, I'm going to go on RIP for an hour or 90 minutes and do a call block. And then I'm going to come out of that. I'm going to do some emails for a bit. Then I'm going to go and do another call block. And then I'm going to, you know, do my manual research. And then I'm going to go do another call block. And you can kind of, it gives them freedom and flexibility so that when they are dialing, they're just focused on dialing. When they are emailing, they're just focused on. It's kind of the opposite of the triple touch. Again, try it. It might not work for you. There's a very good chance it will underperform what you're currently doing.
No, but that's good. Like we said, we're here to talk about what's working for you. So I was curious to try and understand that. So now you are talking about, so you have your two sequences for a prospect. So you have the one for cold email and then one for calls. So what will be next in your process?
That's where it really depends on like the on a client by client basis. But generally the SDR has the freedom flexibility to kind of keep calling that list. We have certain set points at which we will re-enrich the list. We want them to have a certain number of like contacts that they're working. And so we'll continuously top those up. And then we'll also test between different markets, different sequences. We also differentiate our process between, is this a brand new company doing brand new things? Or is this an established company, established market, right? If it's established, we're going to spend a lot more time on one vertical. We're going to go through a lot more thoroughly because we have, the client has signals or, not signals, but like reason to believe that, hey, this is worth investing in. If this is a brand new startup and they have four customers, they probably shouldn't be outsourcing. But if they have, say, 20 customers and they're trying to, you know, they just hit $1 million in revenue, they're trying to find more, then we're probably going to go a little bit wider and do a little bit more of our like market validation approach where we're going to go really, really thin, skim along the top, see which kind of market segments or hypotheses hit, and then kind of double down from there. So that's where it's like, it's almost always these two channels. We do also use social in certain circumstances. It kind of depends. We also use personalized email in certain circumstances. But that's generally how it works. The exception that we're experimenting with right now is a tool called Trellis. It's Trellis, but with a U, trellis.ai. I think they went through Y Combinator. They got some really great cold calling stats, and they're a power dialer that lives on top of your Apollo. So instead of investing the whatever it is a month for Aurum, this is a fraction of the price because they don't have to do any of that. It just gives you that like focused dialer mode. And what we're seeing is it's compared to bare Apollo dialing, it's doubling the output of our SDRs. Whereas like Aurum could like triple or quadruple. But if you're doing Aurum versus Aurum two lines versus Trellis, what we're finding is it's about the same.
Does your team use Clay, or Clay is more here like to be in the back end? And so you build everything for them, and what's the process?
Yeah, we try and design, like we've got some templates that we work with that our team has built. And to answer your question, the SDRs aren't using Clay very often. There's a couple of like phone number enrichments that they can use. Like templates, and they just import the list and they go through. I think if you're using, yeah, it's a challenging tool to teach to 10, 15, 100 SDRs. It's not something I'd recommend. This is a tool that I think firmly belongs in the hands of a RevOps person that understands data structures and all that kind of stuff. So we're generally doing that for our SDRs, pushing the list into where they need to be so that our SDRs can just focus on hitting my dials, making my calls, you know, improving the messaging, personalizing this, doing the, yeah, hand research that makes SDRs good at what they do.
Earlier, you were talking about the account scoring intent on the account. So what other ways do you use Clay actually for improving the efficiency of your team?
For us, the biggest get with Clay is the scoring. It's hard to say all this in theory. So why don't you and I talk through how I would do a Clay account scoring or account qualification model for you.
Yeah.
Cool. So we'll do all the standard, like what size of business, this and that. But what I want you to think about is say I've booked a meeting for you. It's happening tomorrow. You're doing your pre-call research. Okay. You're looking at their website. You're looking at their LinkedIn. I want you to think about, so tell me, first off, tell me who it is that this meeting is with, and then tell me what you're going to look at on their website and what you're going to look at on their social to tell if this is like, oh, this is one that I'm excited about or one that you don't really care too much about.
I'm going to pick the example of my former company, so Castor. I was a funding rep there, funding BDR. So for context, buyer persona were data leaders, so VP of data, chief data officers, data engineers. A lot of technical buyer persona. With this person, actually, what was interesting was that persona in industry was you won't find a lot of information online, which was kind of challenging if I'm comparing to other solutions I used to work for. So where you can just go to website, you see the tech, you say, oh, that's a good fit. So here was what I was doing a lot was research online, podcast episodes, the transcript of the episode to find the tech stack, the challenges that they might face. If it's a peer company, 10K. And I forget to mention the size of this company were from 500 employees to 10,000 headcount. And most of the time we are finding the info inside the job description because the tech, you can't find it on the website, unfortunately, because we were selling to the data stack and the data stack is not on the website most of the time. So you will find it on the job description if they're hiring people. On the data leaders, they love to share their stack on their LinkedIn profile. So it's pretty easy to find certifications, stuff like that. So it was a lot of research this way. And something I also learned was the title they were using inside the team. Because if you compare to a sales team, they were pretty, how do you say that? They had like, not SDRs, but in a sales team, you have like an SDR. Maybe you have someone like we're talking about right now, someone who built the list, the SDR team, an AE, CSM, account management. In the data team, you have like a similar structure. You have a data engineer, a BI team, analytics engineers. You have a lot of different positions. And what I found was there is a title, pretty new, analytics engineer, that like in the SaaS industry, an SDR, you will always find an SDR in the SaaS industry. I know now SDRs, you might find them in more traditional companies, but most of the time, an SDR is in the SaaS industry. And what I was doing was with Clay. I was using Clay to do the research on this account was, in this account, can you find like an analytics engineer? Analytics engineer is like pretty new title. It's like maybe 3-4 years ago, they started using this name. And so I know if this company was using this title, in terms of the research, it was going to save me so much time because I don't need to do the full research about the account. I know if they have this title, I know that's a pretty good start.
With all of that, I've taken a couple notes. And listeners, I mean, give us some slack. We didn't plan this ahead of time. I just kind of threw this on them. So what I heard was tech stack, certain job titles, certain data structures, or certain kind of like, probably like possibly dev methodologies or things like that.
Yeah, that's another good point. So I forgot industry also, because if you match the current customer list with, that's also another thing to consider.
So for this particular company, I would start on like either LinkedIn or Apollo, and you get your base filters in, revenue, employees, industries, those kinds of things. I generally go a little bit wider. And then in Clay, what I would look for is, this is on a company table. I would automate a Google site search to find their 10K and see if I can pull that in and then process it and pull into raw text. And then from that raw text, now this is a bit harder to do, but sometimes you can find a keyword in the raw text and you can have it output true, false, blah, blah, blah. Step one. And I'm like, I'm 20% confident that you could do that. I've done a version of it, but it depends on if they publish them as PDFs or raw text or whatever it is. I've done a version of it. It's hard to do, but it's when I say hard to do, it's because it can be fragile in the process. But generally, you can pull a company S1 and you can pull a PDF and you can pull these things. It's just trying to get the those things, all the variables lined up. So first step is that. Second step, I would do a GitHub enrich on the company level. And so you can find what repos they're following, what they posted, and you can kind of pull that into plain text and say, hey, does it follow, or are they using any of the technologies that I think would match the ones that I want to cover? So does it matter if they're React or Ruby, or if they're using these particular, you know, machine learning frameworks, or if they're AWS or, you know, Kubernetes or whatever? Like, you can find keywords on GitHub. I would also find a couple of folks and enrich the individual and then find their GitHub and then see what they're contributing to. I would also do kind of what you were doing, which is the job description. Now, there's two things I would do here. I would look for jobs that have been posted, and I would look for job titles that they're posted and hiring for. I would also look for job titles that they might be rolling up to as like signals in the job posting. Cause sometimes titles can be weird, and sometimes job postings, job descriptions can be a little bit more accurate than what's on LinkedIn or what's on a company's website. But I'd also use those job descriptions, the job advertisements, to look for technologies. That's the best place to find, you know, other than HG data. If you can afford the, I think it's $10,000 a year for their Salesforce add-in, where you can just see all the technology. They do this. They've been doing this for a long time. They have great data. I had access to it once. It's amazing. It's really, really great. If you're trying to sell an Oracle 10G database and you only want to go to, or you've got an add-on that only works with an Oracle 10G, you can go and basically they gather their data by doing exactly this, but at scale.
Yeah, specifically because, for example, I forgot to mention about the product, for example, that's a data catalog. So in the data catalog, basically, the integration we had was with the 3-4 biggest data warehouses, Snowflake, BigQuery, and then the BI tools, Tableau, those tools. And you know, if they use them, that was also a good sign.
I would search job descriptions for those keywords. And yeah. And so I would have like 3 or 4 rows and be like, hey, do they have a Redshift? Do they have a BI? Do they have a this? Do they have a that? And then you use those as signals to kind of prioritize if they have a Redshift, if they have a this, if they have a that. You can also you can find some sample folks that match the job description. And one having, you can do with Clay, you can do a count. So say there was like a data engineer role was like, you know, if they had 16 of those or more, then it's a great fit. So you can do a count in Clay that says, okay, this is how many, you know, search for this job title, but count and tell me how many. Don't give me the names. I just want you to count. And so I would use that. And what you can do with those is you can do a profile of, how many managers do they have? How many directors do they have? How many engineers do they have? And you can get a sense of their org structure in 4 or 5 queries. And so now you not only have like, you know, what they're, you know, that they have engineers and they have these specific types of engineers, but you can also infer their structure.
That's funny because Dex, you mentioned that because with the co-founders, we had like, thinking about what's the right titles. If they have this title, is it the good one or not? And for example, we were talking about there is another title that I didn't mention that with Clay Data, actually, that's the way we used to say, okay, actually, maybe it's not the title we should aim for. It's data governance. So I'm not going to explain what they do specifically, but the hypothesis was if they have a data governance leader inside the company, it means they're more willing to buy the solution. We did the analysis with Clay, and only 10% of the account from the customer list were having this title. So is it relevant to only go after a company with data governance leaders? Maybe not. So, and that's why we're using the
tech stack. But you can go after them first, right? You know, you find like 10 different things like this, and this is it all kind of goes into a scoring mechanism.
But the assumption was companies buy because they have this title. We had like a certain amount of customers and only 10% of them were having this title. So,
I thought you said 10% of the market had this type of, no, 10% of your customers.
Exactly. So that's why we are saying, okay, maybe it's not the title we should aim for. If this account, they don't have this title, maybe that doesn't mean they will buy the solution. So we were scoring based on the stack and other titles that this one were not impacted the score for if it was a good account or not.
I just want to highlight that you're doing something really important here. And that's one of the most critical pieces you can do if you're trying to design something like this, a scoring mechanism like this, is use the sample data that is your current customer list and then see what the results are going to be. Take 10, 50, 100 and enrich them and see what the scores would be and see if that checks. I've seen so many people use Clay, they don't do this and they build these hypothetical, oh, I could probably do this. Yeah, and so use your existing customer sample as and then show it to other people. Like, hey, here's what I have scored our current accounts. Is this a good scoring mechanism or not a good scoring mechanism? And then just keep testing and iterating. And there isn't going to be just one. It's unlikely that there's just one enrichment in Clay that's going to get you the thing. It's usually a combination of a whole bunch of them that's going to unleash, oh, I can run this play to this 30% of my audience. I can run this play to this 10% of my audience. I can run this play to this, but I'm going to use this to prioritize. This is how I go from a list of 1,000 to, you know what, these are the 10 that I'm going to hit up today.
That's actually the way we should stop doing the research, but it's based on you want to look for the commonalities within your customers and see how you can research that with your prospects.
If you want a cheat code, you can grab your list of customers, throw it into Apollo, download the entire thing in Apollo. And then I've got if you email me, I'll see if I can find the prompt. But I wrote a prompt that basically you can loop through one variable at a time and it'll compose a little report for you. It'll tell you what variables are more likely. I wrote it when the spreadsheet analysis function just rolled out. So it might need a little bit updating, but that's one thing that we've been using as well when it's not as obvious. You want somebody to do a little stats and you got a bunch of customers.
I think doing this, it's also great because it's not just based on assumptions, because it's based on data. You have the data, technographic data, size. So you have a lot of data that can prove why this segment of your customer could be a good one. Okay, so I know we are already on time. So I think it was a great conversation. And thank you so much for explaining, I would say, the concept, because I think it's pretty new, even though that a lot of people talk about Clay on LinkedIn, a lot of people talk about AI tools and the way they use it. But today that was on the show, that was the first time we were talking about how to apply this to an SDR team and how you can scale the efficiency of your team. And I think it can work for an agency, but also in-house. And I think that was a great way to start talking about that and see what's possible. So.
Thanks for having me on. I mean, I think we kind of buried the lead in that this effectively helped me double the output of my SDRs. And so if you're thinking about, can I do this internally? Like we doubled the expectations. We doubled cut the number of SDRs that we had in half. We didn't cut it in half. We just were able to handle twice as many customers, but we cut our requirements in half basically. And so, yeah, it's doubled. You could probably do a little bit more if you're trying to go super broad with dialing up like 5 lines. Like if I was working a target list of like a million, you could go super, super hot and heavy with Aurum and just get 5-10 lines going because you don't care about burning through the list. But I'm trying to share what would work for us. And this doubled the output of our SDR team in less than a year. So there's your stat.
Thank you so much, Colin. Before we end the episode, do you have anything else you want to share?
Yeah. I mean, you can check out our podcast, Predictable Revenue Podcast, where we get your podcasts. I've got if you're a founder that's building revenue, I've got a newsletter that I write just for founders where I share all the things that I fucked up. It's a hard newsletter to write every week, but I get a really great response from it. Like get a big list and we probably get 30 to 50 replies, just people replying to the newsletter every week. And so that's really fun. And if you're looking for help with Clay stuff or sales dev, outsourcing, consulting, predictablerevenue.com, or hit me up on LinkedIn, Colin with 2 L's, Stuart, the correct way. And love to hear from you.
Thank you. And thanks everyone for listening to this episode. I see you on the next episode. If you enjoyed this episode, feel free to leave a review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. So for Spotify, to leave a review, what you can do is you can use your phone, then go on the Spotify app, then you go to the SDR Game page, and then at the top of the page, you can leave a review. It's a 5-star review if you enjoyed the episode, obviously. And then if you are listening to this episode on Apple Podcasts, feel free also to leave a review on your app. Thanks for listening, and I see you on the next episode.